state of Wisconsin.
Good morning. My name is Lee Prey, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I'm representing the state in this case, who is the petitioner. Before I begin, I just wanted to thank the court and opposing counsel for being so understanding and rescheduling the argument.
Well, we are sorry for the reasons that we had to reschedule this, Ms. Prey.
Thanks, I appreciate that. There are three issues before the court today. The first issue deals with exigent circumstances and whether Officer Berlin had exigent circumstances when he entered Patrick Richter's trailer without a warrant. The second issue, if exigent circumstances are not found, the court will have to decide whether Patrick Richter's voluntary consent to the search dissipated the taint of any illegal activity. In other words, whether the attenuation doctrine applies. And the third issue deals with the notice of appeal and whether the state's notice was timely. I'd like to address those issues in that order. With respect to the exigent circumstances, I would ask the court to put yourself in the place of Officer Berlin in those early morning hours on October 12th. It was 4:30 in the morning, and he's in his squad car, and he receives a dispatch that there's a burglary in process. Right at that point, any reasonable officer, I think, would contend that he's possibly entering a dangerous situation. It's early in the morning. People are normally asleep in their beds at 4:30 in the morning. Burglaries are the kind of situation where if a burglar is surprised by occupants, there's likely to be some sort of harm either to the suspect or to the burglar. Anyway, he proceeds to the scene of the burglary in progress. En route, he gets a second dispatch, and that dispatch tells him that the suspect has been seen running from that trailer, it's in a trailer park, on foot. He arrives at the scene, a woman is waiting outside for him, flags him down, and says, "A man tried to get into my trailer. I saw him run out of my trailer, and I saw him enter the trailer across the street, Mr. Richter's trailer." At that point, the officer moves over to Mr. Richter's trailer. He notices that there's a screen knocked out of the window. It's next to the door. The window's wide open. It's October. It's 4:30 in the morning. He has, and any officer, I think, would have reasonable concerns for the safety of the people in that trailer.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
I'm following this on page 17 of your brief just to, because are these facts, as you set forth, those that the trial judge looked at those, just as you recited here, there seems to be, I won't say there's a different version, but when we're talking about hot pursuit, and I guess that there are different versions, and you cite the Smith case that found it was not immediate and continuous because it had occurred 3 weeks before, but this, I mean, this seems to be, I'm listening to your rendition, mm-hmm. that if hot pursuit doesn't mean you're right behind the coattails of the person, but based on what the officer knew, mm-hmm. he knew, he got a call, and within a couple of minutes, it had to be within 1 or 2 minutes, he was there and had this description and ran across wherever this other trailer was. I mm-hmm. haven't quite determined how far it was from where the woman that allegedly flagged him down was, mm-hmm. but is there another version to this?
No, the only testimony that occurred at the suppression hearing was Officer Berlin's. There was no other contradictory testimony, and you've got his complete right. testimony there in front of you. So those are pretty much the facts of the case that we have to rely on here. And I think it's true that this was pretty immediate response. Whether or not you technically delineate that as hot pursuit or whether it some other exigent circumstance applies, such as the speedy apprehension of an unknown suspect, and there's certainly case law that even predated the hot pursuit the hot pursuit analysis, which is the United States Supreme Court case Hayden, where it's certainly an exigent circumstance that when an officer needs to apprehend a person who is unidentified, so if that person flees out of the area, it's not an easy thing to track that person down. You don't know where they live. You don't know who they are. That even if it isn't technically hot pursuit, there still is the very recognized under Smith, part of the exigent circumstances that you are trying to prevent this person from fleeing, a suspect from fleeing from the scene of the crime. So the Officer Berlin gets to the window. He sees the window's wide open, the screen's knocked out. I think he had some genuine concerns, and any reasonable officer would have genuine concerns for the safety of the occupants inside. He looks in the window. Indeed, there are occupants in this trailer sleeping there, and he attempts to wake them up with his flashlight. Two people wake up. They come. He directs them to the door. He briefly talks to them, ascertains that they don't live there, but that Mr. Richter, who's sleeping in the front room, does. At this point, the officer is responding to a crime, what he believes is a crime in progress. He knows that an intruder has been seen going into this trailer. He knows there are people in there. He doesn't know where the intruder is. There are other rooms other than this front room. He doesn't know whether that intruder is trying to get out a back window. He doesn't know if there's other people in there. And there's not a lot of time here to ask further questions. There certainly isn't time for him to go back to his squad car and call up for reinforcements. There's certainly not time at 4:30 in the morning for him to obtain a warrant in order to go in there. I don't know, but if there was a report, if my neighbor called up the police and said there's a report of somebody trying to get into their house, and that they saw that intruder come to my house and actually go into my house, I want the police.
Wait. The other people saw him go into
this trailer? Mm-hmm. Yes. The woman who flagged down the officer when he got there said, there's a man tried to get into my house, and I saw him leave my house, and I saw him go into Mr. Richter's trailer. So he knew that intruder was in that trailer. I would like the police to respond to that, and I'd like them to respond in a quick fashion to protect my safety, protect my children's safety, to protect my property. I think it's what Officer Berlin did was what any reasonable officer would do. This isn't the kind of situation where there was a planned arrest, like in Smith, and they had time to get a warrant before they arrived at the scene. This is an officer dealing with a situation with a crime in progress. It's also not the kind of situation where it would have been easy for them to stake out the trailer and make sure that nobody would flee. First of all, there were only two officers on the scene, according to our testimony. First of all, Officer Berlin came first, and then he was accompanied by a second officer. And secondly, there were people in this trailer. And it isn't a safe situation to stake out a trailer where there are officers outside and there are people inside and there's a suspect inside. That's just not safe.
Is it clear from the records at what point the second officer arrived at the scene?
It is not. That's not clear. The only thing it appears from the record that Officer Berlin was there by himself first, and then the other officer, the first we hear about the second officer is when actually the search was begun.
We don't know if he was there at the time of entry.
We don't know that.
And are we to infer from this record, that the entry was uninvited?
We don't know that either. That was a specific discussion that was had. There was the suppression hearing. There was a suppression hearing and an original decision, and then there was a second decision later on. And in that hearing on the second decision, there was a conversation between the court and the attorneys for both sides. And the attorney for Mr. Richter was suggesting that the two people who were awakened had been asked their consent, but the court very specifically found on the record that all we know from the record is that those two people said we don't live here and that Mr. Richter owns the trailer. We don't really know how the officer got in, whether he asked for consent, whether they gave him consent or not. But I don't think that really has, we're not claiming that there was We're claiming that there were exigent circumstances, so I think that's not a factor that really plays into this at this point.
What are the sources of the facts
that this court can rely on. There's a finding of facts by the trial judge.
That's right. And in this case, and this sort of goes to the second issue, which is whether the state's notice of appeal is timely. There are two sets of findings of fact, and they do differ. The state contends that we should be relying on the second, the March 30th order, because it is more complete and it is more accurate. We contend that the court in this case signed the second order to correct the inaccuracies in the first order. The first order left out the very important fact that this happened at 4:30 in the morning. It left out the fact that the window was wide open. It left out the fact that the woman, that this intruder that was seen going into Mr. Richter's house was also tried to get into the neighbor's house first. But most importantly, that first March 18th order states that the two people that were awakened by the officer were asked for their consent for the officers to enter, and that they denied that consent, saying they were just guests. And that clearly is not in the record. And the court, in its oral decision, said clearly that's nowhere in the record. So I contend that we should be relying, first of all, on the findings of fact in the March 30th order, and then also the record is very clear and not in great dispute here, because there was only one person testifying at this suppression hearing, and that's Officer Berlin, and his testimony is entirely uncontradicted. And it's...
Well, let me ask this. Mm-hmm. Suppose that Officer Berlin testified to something at the suppression hearing, and it was not reported as a fact by the, or found as a fact by the judge. How do we deal with that?
I think you can still rely on the record of the suppression hearing. That testimony was accorded, there was cross-examination, and so that testimony, I think, you can rely on that as a factual basis for what occurred here. I don't think we can move back into things such as the complaint and use things out of the complaint to fill in some of the details here, because the complaint wasn't subject to any kind of cross-examination, and it wasn't submitted at the suppression hearing. But I think you can use everything at the suppression hearing. If there had been a trial here, you could even use the testimony that's elicited at trial. There wasn't a trial here, but I think it's very clear you can use whatever facts were produced at the suppression hearing.
Were there any findings of fact that you disagreed with?
In the second order, in the March 30th order, no. In the March 18th order, yes. I think that there critically was particularly that one fact about consent that was not accurate.
I thought the maxim was that we can scour the record, the evidentiary record, to uphold the determination of the circuit court, but not to circumvent or undermine the determination, the findings of fact of the circuit court. Do you have any response to that?
Well, I believe in this case that the findings of fact in the March 30th order would support that there were exigent circumstances, but I also think that they're not in conflict with what was brought out at the testimony at the hearing, so that I think you can rely on the testimony at the hearing to fill in some of the details and inferences that need to be made to make a decision.
Well, what is the strongest argument in terms of the exigency?
I think it's just that this was an officer responding to a crime in progress in the field, and you need to give some deference to those kind of decisions. There's a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking where it may not have been the absolutely best thing decisions that he made at every point, but they were reasonable decisions. And what we're dealing with in Fourth Amendment is whether the decisions that the officer made were reasonable. And I think that the fact that there were people in the trailer, the fact that he knew the intruder was in the trailer, the fact that the intruder was unidentified and therefore could flee without being tracked down, those are all weighed very heavily in the finding that there are exigent circumstances.
How do you know that the intruder was in the trailer if you also are arguing that there was fear that the intruder would flee?
I think that although there isn't, I will admit, there isn't a definite explanation of the time factor here. From the way that the events unfolded, I think it's pretty clear that things were happening pretty quickly. The officer responded to the burglary in progress when he got there. This woman tells him that she saw somebody run into that trailer, and he immediately proceeded over there. It is possible that the intruder had already gotten out a back window, but I don't think the police could rely on that possibility when people's lives were in danger. I think the police had to assume that somebody was in there and they had to act to protect those people.
Did you see any significance? I was just looking at the record here that the officer, this is on Appendix 115, line 7, that I believe that he ran to the trailer at 439, which was right across the street, broke into the trailer because the screen was lying on the sidewalk or the front porch, which was, it seemed to me that it wasn't just, you can have the screen out of a window.
Right.
This was what I perceived to be an unusual place for the screen either to be lying on the sidewalk or on the front. It looked like it had been done hurriedly. Mm-hmm.
Certainly, by the time the officer went over there, I think he reasonably believed that somebody had broken into this trailer and gone through the window. Now, Mr. Richter points out that when he looked in the window, there were people sleeping in there. Perhaps that then made him reconsider how the person got in the trailer. These people were soundly asleep. He still could have gotten through the window. But the fact of the matter is, he knew there was an intruder, that an intruder had gone into that trailer, and he knew that there were people in that trailer.
And he also knew that this male who was described to him did break into the trailer at 4:38 because he said that.
Well, now when he shone the light into the trailer, he could see the two people sleeping, but he could also see Pat Richter on the couch.
It's not clear. I think it's clear that he saw three people. I'm not sure he saw the fourth person. There was a fourth person asleep in there.
Right. Well, I think his testimony is that after he got in, he saw the fourth person. They were sleeping in the front room. I could also see another male who was later identified as Richter, I'm reading from 115, sleeping on the couch in the front room. Sable and Duffer came to the front door. I found out they didn't live there, but Richter did, as they told them. And he was the male sleeping on the couch in the front room. I think it was in the defendant's brief about what good police practices are, and I don't know how you find that out, but that the police practice would be to call out the people from the trailer so that if there was an intruder, he would get them out of there so that they would be away from harm. They could also talk to him more freely. I mean, that's my understanding of police instructions. Now, do you have anything on that? Or am I making all this up?
I don't know. The police officer wasn't asked that question, whether it would have been better to call in there or not. The defense attorney didn't ask that question. I think there's some risks in doing that, too. If one of the purposes of exigent circumstances is to catch a suspect who's likely to flee, certainly by calling out, you're more likely to have that person flee. I think by calling out, you may set up a dangerous situation where if the suspect was in a place that he couldn't easily get out of, he knows that there's a police officer after him, and that he's set up for a confrontation. So I think my bottom line here is that in this kind of situation, you've got to give some deference to the police officers and what they're doing in the field, and that they've got to make some quick judgment calls This officer made some quick judgment calls, and I think he made them for the purpose of protecting the occupants. He made them for the purposes of catching the suspect, and he made them for the purpose of protecting that person's property. And I think exigent circumstances ought to apply. I think what he was doing was reasonable under the circumstances.
You put hot pursuit under exigent circumstances. Is that usually the way it's characterized?
I believe so, yes, as one of the exceptions that could be.
And under exigent, is it a subclass under exigent circumstances or a separate category?
I think it's a subclass under exigent circumstances.
What about the caretaker?
That's, I think, separate, and we're not really arguing
you're
that.
You're not arguing.
No.
Did you argue that at the Court of Appeals?
Yes, we did. And I'd like to just quickly, I see the yellow light on, address the attenuation doctrine. And I think under State versus Phillips, which is this court's most recent decision, it's very clear that attenuation should apply in this case. Mr. Richter did freely and voluntarily give his consent for the search. There's no idea here that there was any kind of police misconduct or flagrant kind of activity. Mr. Richter, the police officer may have, if you find there isn't exigent circumstances, had the mistaken belief that he had exigent circumstances, but he didn't purposefully go in here with the idea that he was going to use his illegal entry to get evidence of some crime. Mr. Richter wasn't a suspect here. The whole doctrine of attenuation really is directed at the final portion of the attenuation doctrine, which is whether there's flagrant police misconduct, is really the most important part, I think, because it really addresses directly the whole purpose of the exclusionary rule. So that I think in this case, there's the three factors that you look at in attenuation really apply. First of all, Mr. Richter wasn't in custody, so the situation around the consent was non-threatening, non-custodial. There was an intervening circumstance. He should have known with all the information that he was given that he had the option of saying you can't search. After all, they were going in there and asking him to search for his own protection. He should have been able to... A reasonable person under those circumstances would feel that they could reject that offer of protection. And finally, there just wasn't any flagrant activity on the part of the police officers.
What about the Court of Appeals' arguably bright-line rule that there has to be a warrant, admonition, that we don't have a search warrant?
I think that there isn't a bright-line rule. I think there is not a bright-line rule. You're looking at the totality of the circumstances, and really, under that factor, the intervening circumstances, what you're looking at is whether the consent was given under the person's free will, whether they had enough information to decide whether or not they could refuse the search. And I think in this situation, it was obvious, or should have been obvious to Mr. Richter, that they didn't have a warrant. And it should have also been obvious to him that since they were asking to search in order to protect him, that he had the option of saying, no, I don't want you to do that.
And the Court of Appeals said, we conclude that because the officers failed to inform the defendant's wife, the defendant's wife, that they did not have a search warrant or that she did not have to consent to the search. The intervening factors did not vitiate the illegality.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that incorrect?
Because this whole concept between that intervening factor, and this is where they're talking about whether you have to tell them that there's a search warrant, is the idea it was the consent given from free will. And it helps if you tell somebody that they don't have a search warrant to determine that they'll know that that person can refuse and that if they consent, then that's their free will, not some sort of coercion. But in this kind of situation, that was not necessary. Mr. Richter should have reasonably known that those officers did not have a search warrant. And he should have reasonably known that since he wasn't a suspect and they were just asking to search the house to protect him and his property, that he could say, no, I don't want you to search my house.
Reasonableness comes up a lot in the argument, both in terms of the reasonableness of the officer's conduct and the reasonableness, now you're saying, of the defendant. How reasonable is it that someone disturbed apparently from a heavy sleep and says, you know, can you search you out of that sleep? I don't automatically intuit to that person a laundry list of, well, he reasonably should have known that they can't come in without a warrant, you know, at 4:30 a.m. when he's just... It doesn't seem as reasonable as you're suggesting to me. Respond to that.
Well, the only testimony we have here about Mr. Richter's response to what was going on here is that the officer saying that he didn't threaten him, the officer saying that he didn't appear to be frightened, and the officer saying that he appeared to understand what was going on. Now, that was uncontradicted. And then you have Mr. Richter responding, yeah, that's cool. That, to me, does not sound like a person who's confused, who's frightened, who is being coerced into allowing the search. That, to me, sounds like a person who is making a reasonable decision under the circumstances.
What's the time between his entry and the
other school? It's a short period of time, but there's enough time so that he's been awakened and that the officer explains to him what happened. He explains to him that a neighbor had somebody try to get into their trailer and saw that person go into his trailer and then the officer requests for the search. And then the response is, yeah, that's cool. I have a red light, so I don't know.
Okay. You have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Is it Alicia? Alicia, Assistant State Public Defender representing Patrick Richter.
Good morning. We've spent most of our time this morning talking about the exigent circumstances and the attenuation issue. I don't want to leave out the cross-petition issue, which is the timeliness of the notice of appeal. So what I'd like to do is reserve a few minutes at the end where I can touch upon that and answer any questions that you have. But returning to the exigent circumstances, there's one point. But if we can all leave here remembering this point, this is the one I want everyone to remember, and that's this is an entry into a home. This is somebody's home. This is Pat Richter's home. And the Fourth Amendment was designed to prevent warrantless entries into a home. Yet that's what happened here. These are presumptively unreasonable entries. We start with the idea that this is presumptively unreasonable, and it's the state's burden to show us that it wasn't. So keeping in mind that this is a home, throughout all this discussion, the other important point I have is that it was very simple in this case to avoid this warrantless entry into the home. Talk a lot about the difficulties in making quick decisions in the field and officers having to process a lot of information and make these decisions involving the safety of people, and I understand that. But in this case, let's not forget, the owner of the home was asleep, and the officer saw him. And the officer is talking to two people who could have gone and woke Mr. Richter up and brought him to the door, and then we may not be here today. So there may be a lot of situations where officers have to make decisions like this and enter a home, but this case has facts that made it very easy for the officer to avoid that.
Now, how would the officer... Just so I understand that the officer knew, as I asked the opposing counsel, was that a woman flagged him down, said someone tried to break in here, he went immediately across the street, and your discussion here is that the officer then would have asked Mr. Richter, did you see someone come in? And
What if he would have said, no, I didn't, and the woman said, I saw him go right in. And so what, let's say the officer said, yeah, that's fine,
sorry, and then he leaves the home, and something unforeseen happens, like the man had a knife or gun, and it was used. I'm sure that the officer's judgment would have been questioned for just accepting that fact.
Well, the way I envisioned the conversation taking place is very similar to what actually happened. What the officer did may have been the correct thing, but he could have done it before he crossed the threshold. In other words, maybe Mr. Richter would have said, yeah, that's cool. Search. And the officer could have done that. But that could have all taken place prior to the entry. That all the same issues could have been resolved, and the officer could have addressed his safety concerns, but that could have happened before he walked through the door. And again, it was so simple in this case. You know, I can't imagine there are too many cases where the officer will actually be able to see through the window the homeowner. And I think there are important balances here, and certainly the officer's judgment is something that we really do need to consider. But as I said, this is the sanctity of the home. This is a home. And I think that really has to be taken into consideration as well. Because of that, we're certainly arguing that there weren't exigent circumstances in this case. The main argument the state has seems to be a concern over the threat to safety, that the officer was concerned about the safety of the people in this trailer. What I'm concerned about is forcing this into a black and white situation. Either the officer goes in right then, enters the home without a warrant, or the officer has to stand outside helpless and go get a warrant or do nothing. And that's not true. There's a lot of room in between those two options. And that's where this case, again, could have been avoided, is in that gray area. The officer gets Richter up and brings him to the door. Well, that doesn't require either a warrant or a warrantless entry. I'm not saying that the officer has to have a half-hour conversation with Mr. Richter to get a lot more information. I think the conversation, again, could be very brief. Here's what I understand happened. I see there's a screen out. Maybe Mr. Richter says, well, yeah, that screen has been out. Well, that changes the fact situation a little, too. I also submitted to the court the weather data for that day. Now, normally you would think October in Marinette, it would be pretty cold, and the window open might be an odd thing. But as it turns out, the high that day was 66, and the low was 53. And you're in a trailer, and there are four people sleeping in that room.
Alicia, normally these Fourth Amendment concerns are raised by the target of the police. But in this case, Mr. Richter was not himself the target at all. The police were trying to protect him. Does that make any difference?
It does not. I mean, the bottom line is still we have a warrantless entry into the home. And it was, as it was alluded to earlier in the argument, if he's concerned for Mr. Richter's safety and Mr. Richter isn't the target, there's also the possibility of bringing him out of the trailer.
You can see that Richter was not the target.
That was the officer's testimony.
So, and since there was no contradictory testimony, we have to accept that as true.
Well,
and why is it not equally true when he said, I went in there because I sensed that people were in danger?
Well, that may be the reason that he went in there, but that doesn't make his entry legal.
It doesn't?
It doesn't. The officer can perceive
that people inside are in danger. Does that not create exigent circumstances?
This is an objective test. So we have to look at the reasonableness of the officer's conclusion that the people are in danger.
Mm-hmm. And you think that was an unreasonable conclusion?
I think that was an unreasonable conclusion.
And why do you believe that was unreasonable?
I believe that was an unreasonable conclusion because there weren't a lot of facts in this case. And when we look at the facts in this case, they don't add up. They conflict. We have somebody tried to get into my trailer, and he went over there. Okay, the officer goes over to this trailer. He sees the window screen out and the window open. That sounds bad so far, I agree. But then he shines the flashlight, and he sees four adults asleep in the room, in this trailer, with the window open.
Three, actually.
There were four, but right, he may see.
Well, under the finding of fact of March 30th, two individuals later identified as Dufix City awoke and came to the door. Berlin saw two other individuals sleeping in the room. That's a finding of fact. Doesn't say when.
I think it almost becomes irrelevant. You know, you have adults who are sleeping in this room, multiple adults. And I think at that point, a reasonable officer says, well, now this isn't all adding up. How did an adult male, if he did indeed take the screen down and come inside, how did he get in without waking these people up? Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. But the point is we're starting to have some conflict in the information right now. And I'll come back to it again. At that point, the officer can still be concerned about the safety of the people inside, maybe to a lesser degree because of these new facts. All he has to do is have them bring Richter to the door. He's woken up two people with a flashlight.
Would it be unreasonable at that point for the officer to conclude that he might be facing a hostage situation?
Well, you have the four people asleep, so obviously he can get them out.
Sleep can be fainted.
Certainly that's a possibility. Whether I would say that makes the entry reasonable, I still don't believe it. The two people did come to the door when he shined the flashlight. So if that's really foremost in his mind, he can get them out. The other concern that I think is important to remember is I don't know if police officers around the state are wanting to burst into homes. I mean, if we're talking about a danger to people or a hostage situation or concern about safety, does an officer want to put himself by running into the middle of that? Can that escalate it possibly? And I don't think it's so cut and dry that his presence in the trailer makes everybody safe.
I'm having a little difficulty with this argument. As I understood the state, this was not a caretaker function.
Correct.
Which I interpret as threat to safety, that is, to save the people. Their argument is hot pursuit of an intruder. That's a lot different than safety to me, it is anyway.
My understanding of the state's argument is there are sort of two prongs. You have a threat to safety, exits, and circumstance. And in addition to that, there's also the hot pursuit. And then either one could stand on its own.
Say that to me again. Exits and circumstances, according to the state's position, is hot pursuit here.
Yes, and it could also be the officer entering because there's a threat to safety.
That's
an either-or proposition, really.
And so you've been talking about the caretaker threat.
The threat to safety issue. I mean, when it comes to hot pursuit, the cases in hot pursuit really deal with a chase, an immediate and continuous pursuit.
Is that the law in Wisconsin? Because you're saying that there are no cases that you have to be right on the person's coattail. That hot pursuit does not mean the suspect went there and the police are right behind him?
Correct. It would be, it's hard to envision a chase where there's that interval of nobody seeing the person. It sort of becomes an investigation again instead of a pursuit. I think maybe what will make this more clear is if you look at the officer's actions, they really belie any argument that there was hot pursuit because the officer woke two people up and brought them to the door and talked to them.
Well,
then he went in and talked to Richter.
I guess the hot pursuit I was envisioning, as I asked the opposing counsel, was you had the police call, 911, the person that allegedly flagged him down, and the direction he went there, and I guess there was no more than a couple of minutes, I believe 2 minutes that passed between A and B. And all I'm saying is you're saying that is not hot pursuit because he had to stop at the trailer.
Correct.
What are the elements of hot pursuit?
Hot pursuit, there isn't a test, so I wish I could give you a test for it, but basically it's a continuous and immediate pursuit. I think those would be the catchwords, continuous and immediate.
One of the cases I was looking at, the City of Brookfield versus Collar, says, Court of Appeals cases, the officer, three prongs, the officer must act without unnecessary delay, the pursuit must be continuous and uninterrupted, but there need not be continuous surveillance of the suspect,
Finally, the relationship and time between the commission of the offense, the commencement of the hot pursuit, and the apprehension of the suspect is important. The greater the length of time, the less likely it is that circumstances under which the police act are sufficiently exigent. I'm not saying that's the law of the state of Wisconsin, because I haven't carefully enough read the case. But I guess I'm asking you, does hot pursuit have those three elements in the state of Wisconsin? If you know.
As I said, I haven't really uncovered that there's a 1-2-3 kind of test like that. I think that the themes, there seems to be more themes that come up, and that immediate and continuous, and I've added in chase, because there's a case, Santana, that talks about chase. Is this a chase? I can give you an example of what was found to be hot pursuit, which I think, again, was in that Santana case, where they saw the suspect at the door, and when she saw the police, she ran in the house. They ran in after her. That's about, that to me is a nice definition of hot pursuit, because there she is, we cross the threshold of the house because we, in that case, they were fearful she was going to destroy evidence. But again, when you look at the facts in this case, you have an officer who didn't have long conversations with these people, but did take enough break to discuss, wake the people up with the flashlight, talk to them at the door, go in, wake Richter up, talk to him. A perception of me of a continuous and immediate pursuit would be right in the door. You know, this is hot pursuit. I'm going in. I'm not talking to anyone. The danger level, the exigency is here. Clear out of the way. I have this issue to solve. That to me is hot pursuit, as opposed to an officer's action of being a little bit more careful and a little bit more cautious, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. I just don't think it fits in hot pursuit.
What if the officer had not stopped? He gets this message over the radio, because this is important to me, the fact that he's acting. He gets the message that there's a burglary in progress, right? He gets there, and he gets flagged down by the woman who says, the guy who tried to break into my place ran across and ran into that place. What if the officer then had simply gone right into that house?
Well, under our argument, of course, that's completely invalid still. That's an illegal entry. Under the state's argument, I think that's exactly what the state is saying he could do.
But that puts the officer in a catch-22, doesn't it? I mean, if he can't, if he stops to gather further facts, he can't go in because it's no longer hot pursuit. And if he just goes in, it's still wrong.
Well, that might eliminate the hot pursuit exigency, but it might still open up several other exigencies. I mean, just because there isn't hot pursuit doesn't mean he can't go in the house. Maybe he would have discovered more facts and really been convinced that there was a threat to safety and that he can go in. So it doesn't create quite a catch-22. I mean, it eliminates hot pursuit for him. It doesn't eliminate hot pursuit if he drove up in his squad car and saw a guy going through the window. Well, then he goes in. If he doesn't see that, asking a couple of questions could confirm his concern for threat to safety.
Are you saying that if you're asleep in your house and one of your neighbors there's been an attempt to break into your neighbor's house. The police arrive at the scene and she says, he's no longer here, but he ran into Miss Alicia's house. And the police officer runs across the street, sees the screen on the door. He still can't go into your house to check for your residence.
Well, let me put that back in the facts that we have here. I'm asleep in the front room watching. Fallen asleep watching television. He shines his flashlight. I mean, his first instinct is going to be, what's going on here? He shines his flashlight and sees me.
You said 2 minutes ago that he couldn't go in even under those circumstances.
No, he couldn't go in under those circumstances. No.
Well, your position appears to be that the Fourth Amendment protection of a house, a home, outweighs the police need to find somebody who has attempted burglary. That's one position. Maybe it's not.
Well, I don't think it outweighs the police need to find the person. It outweighs the police need to go into the house without
the police. I'll change it. You're right. The police's ability to enter a home without consent and without warrant.
Yes.
Now, That's one fact scenario that deals with hot pursuit. The second fact scenario is the Fourth Amendment protection of a warrantless, non-consensual search of a home does not permit an officer to enter the home if the officer reasonably believes that the occupants are in danger. That's the caretaker safety. You can abide into that.
An officer can enter a home without a warrant if it's objectively reasonable that he believes
right,
there's a grand
danger. That's the test I gave you.
Yes.
You think that would be okay? He could enter. And your position here is that that was not reasonable.
Exactly.
Because he didn't just barge in, which might have been very dangerous to the people inside and himself. He did a fast exploratory examination and saw people sleeping. He saw no indication of danger. That doesn't mean that there wasn't somebody hiding, but he saw no indication of that. So your position then, I assume, is there was no reasonable objective grounds for safety yet.
Yes.
So he continued to explore the safety issue.
Yeah.
And hot pursuit, but you take the position, but just hot, assuming it's even hot pursuit, that you can't barge in, I shouldn't say barge, warrantless non-consensual search. Because
if
he didn't barge.
Correct. If it's true hot pursuit, you can go in, and that's what hot pursuit is. If you're truly in hot pursuit of a suspect, you can go in. But this is not hot pursuit.
Okay. And you say it's not safety because there's no reasonable objective indication that this is safety issue.
Correct. Because of the conflicting information he observed when he looked in that window.
What makes it not hot pursuit? What if the officer had observed this guy running across the street and into the truck into that other pier? Would that benefit hot pursuit?
Yes.
So he cannot simply take the word of a witness. Essentially say, I believe the witness and therefore I ran. He has to have more.
Yes. Yes, because we don't know the time period. We're all talking about it being a short time period, but we don't know for certain exactly how many minutes. We're also talking about a trailer. We don't know how big it is or how small it is.
Do we know how big or small it is?
We don't. We don't know.
It's got a bedroom outside of the room that you can see, because
right.
That's where they enter, right? He enters.
That's where they do the search.
That's right. Because in the area that he could see with his flashlight, which held four sleeping people,
right.
That isn't where they found the marijuana. They walked into the other room, found it on the night table, and found leaves or a branch hanging in the closet, which was open.
Correct.
When you say, and again I'm going back to record, that we don't know the time sequence and the officer's testimony, as I overheard briefly with traffic, that the Marinette Police Department was dispatched to a mobile home, that there was a burglary in progress. Someone was attempting to get in a trailer, and that occurred at 4:30 in the morning. We got there 1 minute late. I mean, so we do know the time sequence. I mean, that's what my question was. This is not something that was 20 minutes later. Seems like it was not simultaneous, but the officer said, well, at 4:30 there was a burglary in progress, and I got there at whenever it was, a minute later at 4:31. And that seems to be a very short time sequence, and as Justice Babich and others have asked, then the witness said, the flagged him down, tried to break in here, and he went there, and that was right across the street. And you're saying it's different if he had seen the person, but because he didn't, even if there's a short period of time, it doesn't make any difference.
Yes.
Am I correct?
Yes.
Okay,
I mean, I don't want to leave the impression that if you don't see him, that means you can't make a warrantless entry, because you can. There's still these other exceptions. You have the threat to safety. You have a risk of destruction of evidence or concern that a suspect might flee. I mean, those are all separate things to analyze. What I'm saying is there's no hot pursuit here. Then we move on to the next one. No, there's no threat to safety either. Well, any one of those might trigger or give the officer the ability to go in.
I guess I'm just looking at what a reasonable officer would have done in that case.
What about the suspect fleeing? Is that different than hot pursuit?
Yes. Because you could be concerned about a suspect fleeing even if there was a large time span in between the time that someone saw them
but
going.
But that wouldn't be give you an exigent circumstance.
It can give you an exigent circumstance. It doesn't in this case because you're looking at a trailer, and we don't know how big it is, but we know at least it's a trailer. We also have the second officer, Absalom, I believe, who was at least there quickly enough to conduct the search after Richter's consent. So pretty quickly we have a second officer there. So in terms of being concerned about the suspect fleeing, you have two officers to keep an eye on this trailer. I think that would be sufficient to watch it and to keep anybody from getting out of it.
I want to make sure I understand the argument, and it seems to me you're arguing a real in these circumstances sort of case. Mm-hmm. That, and I hear your responses and I'm reading these broad premises you're not disagreeing with. So let me, and it seems to me that if I were an officer and spoke with this neighbor lady, it would be reasonable for me to be concerned for someone else's safety. So the lady tells me this, I look across the street at the trailer, and it's reasonable, objectively reasonable, for the officer to be concerned about the safety. And then I get to the front door, and I'm 3 feet from the door, and it's reasonable, objectively reasonable, for me to be concerned about the safety of those inside. I get to that threshold, that one-inch threshold, and in the fact of this case, and then I see these two guys sleeping. They come to the door, as I understand the facts, and say they don't own the place. And now as I understand, your argument is then it's not reasonable for them to step over that inch and go this next 6 feet to talk with that guy because they didn't need, the officer, didn't need to do that for safety. Am I getting the argument mm-hmm. correctly? It's not that it's not reasonable for him to be concerned about safety. That's eminently reasonable, but it was unreasonable under the circumstances of those two fellas coming to the door. And he's seen the defendant sleeping without a warrant walk in. That's your argument.
That's my argument. And you know, you can describe it as an inch and crossing the threshold, but let me come back to how I started. This is a home, and that's a big deal. Yeah, that inch is a big deal.
I mean, what I'm doing is focusing, in my mind anyway, that's what you're talking about. You can cross this threshold without a warrant if you're concerned for the safety, but under this circumstances, it wasn't reasonably concerned with the safety.
Exactly, because of the conflicting facts that he was faced with. That's correct.
Was there a back door to this trailer?
I don't know. That wasn't in the facts.
Were there windows on the back side?
We don't know that either.
Did the officer know?
I don't know.
Who opened the door?
That's unclear from the record also. Unfortunately.
Well, on March 30, it said two individuals later identified as Dufick and Sable awoke and came to the front door. Then it said that, I'm reading at 124, Deputy Berlin determined that Dufick and Sable didn't live there, but Richter did. Number 7, Berlin entered the trailer and woke Richter. He was unable to awaken McFadden.
I'm just about out of time here, and as I said, I don't want to sit down without at least touching on our cross-petition issue, which after all this discussion, I hate to say it, but our position on the cross-petition is we shouldn't be here talking about this. We've already alluded to the fact that there are two orders filed, a March 18th and a March 30th. They do the same thing. They suppress the same evidence. It's the same result. It just happened twice. And the most important issue in the cross petition is finality. When do we have finality? Could another order have been filed and another? What if the state had waited 4 months to file an order? It can go on. And maybe in this case, the facts aren't as egregious because of the timing.
Wasn't that first order submitted in a conditional sort of a way, subject to approval of the district attorney who indicated an intent to run it by justice?
That was the letter that the defense counsel included with the order, explained that and set it all out. But the letter also indicated that it had been, I think, a little more than 3 weeks since the order had been given to the district attorney. And I think that really works in favor of showing that that is the final order, because the judge, knowing all those things, still signed the order. If the judge was concerned that we don't have the DA's approval and I want to have the DA's approval, then the judge wouldn't have signed the order. The judge either would have held a hearing or tried to get the parties to work it out. I think it's very important that we have the judge signing the order, even though he knew that background information.
Is there any local rule about submission of findings and conclusions and orders with the judge's signature and time period for objections?
I don't know that. There is an allusion to a kind of 5-day rule in the state's letter, and that may be the local rule.
And clearly that was not complied with here, because the order was signed the day after it was submitted.
Although it appears that the DA did have a copy of the order for 3 weeks, which was also indicated in the cover letter.
Right, but if there is a 5-day rule locally, then the order should not have been signed before the expiration event to give the DA the appropriate time within which to file a written objection.
I think we might be able to put a little bit of this back on the DA, too, though. I mean, the DA knew that this order was out there, obviously, and the DA even indicates in his letter that he had some concerns with the first order. Yet the DA didn't take any action to check whether the order had been vacated or do anything himself to vacate the order or make a motion to modify or do anything to try to clear up the confusion. And the DA is the person who was appealing, so I think the burden was on him to straighten this out. And he knew there was another order out there somewhere, or another proposed order.
Well, on March 17th, Kenyon writes Keith saying, here's proposed findings. I gave them to the DA. DA hasn't responded. He wants to get on with this, and another hearing on the form. And I gather that the DA only has to approve the form. Is that it?
I'm sorry, I missed that.
The DA only has to approve the form. I'm reading from your appendix in the cross petition.
Okay.
So that's March 17th, and apparently the court dates it March 18th. Now, on March 18th, the district attorney writes a letter to the judge saying, here's my findings of fact and conclusions of law, and that he had problems with it, and he's sending a copy to Kenyon, and if he has any objection, he notified the judge within 5 days. And Kenyon sent a copy to Miron and to Pat Richter. So now, on March 30th, the judge signs this order. I'm assuming he got it on the 19th or 20th or 21st. Is there anything else? Was there any correspondence between these lawyers in this interim?
Nothing in the record.
Anything that the judge indicates he's now signed two orders that are not precisely the same? One assumes that there's a significant enough difference if the attorneys are fighting about these findings.
There's nothing in the record indicating
nothing. And then your notice, the bar's notice of appeal refers to an order dated, entered on March 31. Right?
Correct.
That doesn't match any of those.
It doesn't
match.
That's
just a clerical error. So.
Was there an order dismissing the case at any time?
I don't think there was. I don't recall seeing that in the record.
What happened at the conclusion of the hearing? Was there an oral ruling, and the judge then directed the public defender to prepare findings and conclusions for this submission?
There was an oral ruling, no discussion of who was going to prepare an order or when that would need to be done, and the discussion more moves on to scheduling, and they schedule a status.
So the oral ruling is you win, and no direction to anybody to prepare a writing
Correct. The court says, okay, then the motion to suppress the evidence and statements are granted. And defense counsel says, I think with those taken out of the criminal complaint, it has to be dismissed. And then they argue about whether there has to be a dismissal, and the judge says, 120 days, let's come back and figure this out, basically.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Craig, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
With respect to the notice of appeal issue, it's the state's contention that we're really not talking about this kind of finality analysis that Mr. Richter goes through, because this is a non-final order, and that's not, this is not the situation where you have a group of orders or judgments or decisions all doing the same thing, all saying the same thing, that are not in conflict, and you're trying to determine which is the final order, was contemplated at the final, as the final order at the time it was issued, and which then is the appealable order. That's not what's happening here. What's happening here is you have two orders that they both do suppress the evidence here, but they are different in their findings of fact, which is critically different in a case like this where it's very fact-run, and this court and any reviewing court owes great deference to those findings of fact.
Counsel, if the March 30th order had not been signed, does the March 18th order in form and substance comport with the requirements of a final order?
If the March 30th order had not been signed, the March 18th order, I believe, would be the appealable order.
I have a...
Although, I need to say that there is some indication, even if you apply the finality doctrine here, that there was some contemplation that a future order would be issued, because there was the cover letters that suggested that it was being given to the ADA for approval, and that there was a signature block for his approval, and that wasn't signed. I think that still passed that test. However, I don't think that we're talking about a finality analysis.
I wrote
here.
The Edlin opinion, and that's cited in the brief. And one of the great concerns I have is finality.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason, one of the reasons for that is so that there isn't abuse of the system. I can envision both in civil and criminal law the problem of, well, this is the final order from which I can appeal. No, this is, and then this is. And what we did in Edlin with regard to a civil statute is to perhaps create an exception there. The facts were, it was really the judge's fault. The judge thought he sent a copy to the other side, never sent a copy of the order to the other side, and they didn't find out that the order even existed, that the judge signed it, until way after the appeal time. I think subsequently we had, and I hope I'm not misspeaking, a case involving the Court of Appeals. And again, the same kind of thing. The Court of Appeals failed to do something, and it was the, if you will, the system's fault, the court's fault, the clerk's office fault. But beyond that, we pound on the importance of finality, because that's what our system... you need those kind of rules. You need those kind of bright lines. Without it, forget any time limits for appeal. How do you respond to that, given your statement that in and of itself, March 18th does in form and substance represent a...
I respond to that in that here you're not dealing with a situation where the ADA put in a motion to modify the order. This is not something that was brought about by the parties in the litigation. This is something that the court did in their inherent power to modify that first order. The ADA didn't realize that the first order had been signed. There's no indication that he did. It was signed on the same date that he submitted his proposed order. So you don't have that same idea that this is going to be an abuse of the system. Also, the appellate times had not run. There's no indication that either the court or the parties were trying to extend out the times of appeal. What you've got is a second order that defines the rights of the parties, corrected mistakes that were done in the first order, and is the controlling order in this case.
What if the defense attorney would have then sent an order on April 4th and said, Judge, I disagree with the March 30th order. That this fact is, it wasn't 4:30, it was 4:37, signed this order.
after the appeals times had run.
Well, I'm not even talking now about appeal time. I'm talking about what constitutes a final order. Then would that, under that fact scenario, would that April order be the final order and not this March 30th order?
I think that's different, because then I think you could say that what was happening here was you were having a motion to modify the previous order by the ADA, and the law is that unless there's something new happening, that you can't appeal from a decision denying or granting a motion to modify. Although, that when you extend out that analysis, really what that means is that usually if it's you're denying such an order, you've got a previous order that's in place that's appealable. And if you're granting the order, the reason that order granting it is not appealable is it contemplates another order that indeed modifies. So if what, even in that, and I know I'm backtracking a little bit here, but even if what occurred was that the ADA put in a motion to modify, and that didn't happen here, and the court granted that motion and then issued a second order incorporating those modifications, I think that second order would be appealable. But that is not what occurred here. What occurred here was that the court, in its inherent authority, modified or corrected the first order and issued a second order. And that second order is the only order that can be appealed from. It is the order that has the correct findings of fact that should be under reviewed here and is the controlling order in this case.
What is the defendant's status here? Is this still a pending prosecution?
Yes.
He's on bail?
I'm not really sure, to tell you the truth. I don't believe he's incarcerated, but I don't know that.
I mean, typically, in the ordinary course, with the suppression motion being granted in the way that it was in this case, the case would be dismissed, right?
Correct, and it's been this case that didn't happen. It's being held in abeyance, and I really don't know what the defendant is at this point.
Thank you, Ms. Bray. That concludes our oral argument in 98-1332 CR.